We have the fascinating sugya of Ein Adam Mason Atzma Russia. So that sugya comes up explicitly in our section over here in our Gemara, and it also comes up implicitly. There are a number of different ways in which it's invoked in our sugya, and they're all interesting. And just to give a little background, that's what we'll try to do first, through the context of our Gemara. So we have this principle that a person is not believed if he says something which incriminates himself. It has a little bit of a parallel in American law, although in American law it's different. In American law, the rule is that one cannot be compelled to give testimony in a way that will incriminate himself. That's the Fifth Amendment, hence the expression, taking the fifth. Here we're saying something else, although it would be worth considering if there's any overlap between the principles. Here we're basically saying that should one choose to say something which incriminates himself, he's not going to be believed. Now the scope of that, as we'll see, is open to a lot of discussion and seems to vary from context to context. That's something that we have to figure out a little bit. One thing that we do seem to know, and this is a question some of the guys were asked this morning, so it's important to clarify, Rashi in the Sefer Sivamos, if you saw the sugi in Sivamos and Daf Tokay, it's Daf Yomi now if you're 2 months behind, which is not so unlikely at this point, but it was Daf Yomi about 40-something blot ago, the Mishnah on Daf Tokay, and the Gemara over there, Chafei Yaman Aleph and Chafei Yaman Beis. So there is another sugya of Ein Adam Mason Atzma Russia, and it comes out pretty differently than the sugya, which is something that we have to figure out. And if you did take the initiative to look at Tosfos, so there's a Tosfos that's almost identical, not exactly the same. There's a Tosfos here and a Tosfos in Yavamos that deals with the issue in pretty parallel ways, and we'll try to talk about that in a few minutes. But essentially, Rashi in Yavamos is more explicit than Rashi over here. And Rashi in Yavamos makes the distinction, which is an important distinction to be aware of, that this is different than the rule by Mamo. That if you owe me money, I say you borrowed $100 from me, and you say, yes, indeed I did. So that works. You are indeed chayav then, because that goes under the principle of hodas baldin kemeya edim dami. That the acknowledgement of the litigant, that's a very powerful piece of evidence. That's like 100 witnesses. So that seems to be the opposite of what we're saying here. So indeed, it is the opposite rule. We'll have to talk a little bit more about why it is the opposite rule. But it seems like on the surface, just in terms of the basic elements, and again, Rashi and Yavamos does spell it out this way, is that if we're talking about something punitive, an onesh, like certainly like Misa or Malkos, or in the monetary realm, Knas, something that is beyond the basic monetary obligation. One of the major themes we've been talking about this year, we started off with the Mishnah in the third paragraph, talking about Knas, and so we spent some time, I think, about that in the beginning of the year, the difference between Knas and Mamo. So all of those areas, it seems to be that we have such a principle of Ein Adam Mason Atzma Russia, and including also status issues, that if you're going to, in the very literal sense, define yourself as a Russia, give yourself the status of Soledis and the like, we see the principle showing up there. But in the case where there is a straight monetary obligation, what we call mamon is distinct from knas, so there it seems that we have the opposite rule. And your acknowledgement is not only valid, it's super valid, but if it's an onesh, then your acknowledgement does not have that effect. We'll have to see if there's more to it than that. But again, the succinct statement at this point, look at Rashi over there on that sugya in Yavamos on Daf Tokay. So with that, so the principle of Ein Adam Mason Atzma Russia, where it applies, it seems to be unanimous. It's probably a principle that everyone holds. There are some who feel that it's a machlokes tanan, and I'll give a context to that in a minute. We'll have the context of that after we say a little bit more. But it seems certainly, at least halacha l'maisa, that this is a unanimous principle. even though we find that it's seemingly applied differently in different places. Even though we find that there are very different applications. So we have to figure out exactly how it's applied and when it's applied. So, for example, we find that in our Mishnah, so one of the implicit references to Einod Din Meis Matzah Rashi, I think I mentioned this when we went through the Mishnah just in the basic sense a few weeks ago, that when the Mishnah says that the Eidim are believed to say that when they signed the original Shtar, they were Psulei Eidus, so what kind of Psulim are we talking about? And so, if you remember, we mentioned this question, that Rashi says, what are we talking about, Psulim? Krovim o Mesachkin Bekuvim. Either that they are relatives, so they're possible for that reason, or they are gamblers. So Rashi is interesting both for what he includes and what he doesn't include. Right, what's significant in both directions about Misafi Bakuvia? Somebody want to help me out here?
It's a Darabana.
Okay, so that's the second point. Probably mentioned the other point first, right? But it is a Darabana, right? That seems to be one of the significant issues. Right, what else? Seems like it's a Rashi issue, right? It seems like by bringing this in, Rashi is saying they would be credible to say that they are gamblers, which the Gemara says in Sanhedrin passes them la'edus. It sounds like it's in the category of avera. So there is a discussion in the Rishonim about this. On the one hand, some of the Rishonim say against Rashi that you can't put Misafi Bekuvia into this category because you'll have a problem with being able to make some Atzma Rashi. So Tosus Ridge, for example, writes that no, just leave it as Krovin. Just say that they testified that they were related. And that's enough of an example. But to say Misafi Bekuvia is going to be a problem because of the, you know, the Mesa Matzma Rashi point. Now, Marty?
Just a question about the whole concept.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't they have just said, we used to be Misafi Bekuvia in the past when we signed it, but like now we're not. So why would that be considered being Mesa?
You mean maybe he could have done Chubas since then?
Meaning, why is it? Why can't we see that with any idea of Mesa Matzma Rashi?
So that's also an interesting question. Could you theoretically have a situation where you're credible now? And that's also itself a very interesting issue. So that's a great question to ask. Let's come back to that, as you'll probably see that it probably connects to the question of why do we have this principle in the first place. So it's a very interesting application that what if you want to claim you were a Russia at one point, but you're not a Russia anymore? So how does that factor in? It's a great question. So let's see a little bit more about the reasoning and see how that applies.
Are there some who understand Rashi as not believing in
Rashi himself, no. But there are some who read some Mishnayos as saying that, as we'll see in a second. But for Rashi, that's going to be very difficult.
In the adding of Misafi Bekuvia, would one be able to make that argument? Or
you would have a very hard time because it would be against everything else he says. But you'll have to say something within Rashi, right? So some of the Rishonim are either Ramban and the Ra'ah trying to discuss Rashi. What do you think you could say within Rashi?
So
there's a discussion in Sanhedrin what the nature of the psul is. So you could, as I already mentioned before, you could say there's a distinction here between a psul d'oraisa and a psul d'rabbanan. That's what some of the Rishonim already say. But you have to figure out why that's enough of an answer. So let me just ask you speculatively, why should that matter? Right? What would there be that would indicate that Einod Din Meis Matzmo Rasha is a question of degree? If you violate Yisurim D'Raisa, you're not believed. If you say you violate Yisurim D'Rabbanan, you are believed. How would you sustain such a distinction? You know, so what that it's only D'Rabbanan? Surely?
Rasha is not someone who commits D'Rabbanan, it's very similar. Or Rasha is only someone who commits Yisurim D'Raisa.
So you're saying that the status, it's interesting because there are actually Gemaras that say explicitly that,
right,
you know, somebody over al Dirich Chamim Miznik or Asher. But let's try to expand on that. So basically, when we say, you know, the Mesa Matzma Rasha, so is that about a specific level are we saying that it's not about you didn't have Aver, you didn't have Aver? It's about specifically the status that comes along with it. Right? Essentially, are you saying that, you know, the Mason Maxwell Russia, does that basically mean you can't incriminate yourself on any level? Or does it mean that there's a specific status which is triggered by Averos, but really it's more about the status, and you cannot impose that status upon yourself? So maybe it's only if you reach a certain level, then that's where it's going to kick in, but maybe a lower level Avera is not going to do it. So it's an interesting question to explore. It's not so clear if it's going to be sustainable from any of the sources that we'll see. The problem is that even if you wanted to make a distinction like that, and you wanted to say that it's about status rather than any specific Avera, so it's a little bit difficult because here we're Yudavkar talking about status, that's kind of the whole point. Right? And even though it's a status that's triggered by Drabanan, but it is all about status. And the whole point of Mustafi Pakubya is not really its Avera focus, but rather that it is a issue of imposing the status of Soledis. So even if we wanted to draw the line and say that's really what it's about, it's hard to use that to answer this. Because either way, even if it's Rabbanan, this is an example of status. So it's really not such an easy question to understand. Some want to suggest, in the Sefer Berkas Avraham, he has a suggestion along these lines, that maybe the nature of the psul of Masachet Bekuvi is different. And then the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So the Gemara gives two reasons why it is that a gambler has an edus problem. One is that there is some type of gezel involved, that on some level he's a thief. And why is that the case? Because the assumption is, just to say very quickly, that if you win money gambling, that the money's not really legitimately yours. That if halacha doesn't really recognize that there's an actual debt there, and you're taking the money from the loser, so you're kind of taking it against his will, and therefore it has something along the lines that somewhere in the category is gezel.
That's machlokes, right?
Machlokes what the reason is. Now you might say, well, you're not taking against his will because the guy made a deal. He said, I know, if I lose, I'm going to pay you. So the assumption is he didn't mean it. And even though he said that, but the reason he's playing the game in the first place is because he thought he wasn't going to lose. And therefore this is a concern that we have called asmakta, that somebody made a commitment that wasn't really actually grounded enough, and therefore you shouldn't actually be taking it.
Well, what determines like how grounded, or making the assumption that the guy wouldn't be playing unless if he thought he was going to win?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that's more of like a professional level. Now let's go to more of a casual level and say I'm playing poker with four of my friends on a Thursday night with a $10 buy-in. We're not expecting to win,
thanks
for entertainment.
Well, so the truth is, a very specific description. I know, but what's the address again? The point being that you could have really thought the opposite. The truth is, I thought you were going to ask the question over an opposite way, that you could say that Dafka professional maybe would play if he's
well, because they understand, really.
Right, they understand, and also they play often enough that they may figure that they'll eventually end up with more money. So on any given game, they're prepared to lose under the assumption that they're going to end up with more money later on. So then maybe they did kind of invest in this losing game because they'll have enough winning game.
And it would still be enough.
Right, so it's all a fair question. The truth is, we're learning Sanhedrin. I just learned today that we're learning Sanhedrin next year. Okay, so it's a good teaser. They just had a very involved and protracted discussion about, we just ended our cycle of what the Masechtas are decided many years in advance, but this year is the last year of the cycle, and they hadn't decided the next cycle, so there was a whole contentious debate. These are all the important politics that you're not privy to. Maybe it'll be written up in the papers. But obviously if it was that serious, I wouldn't be talking about it. But in any event, there was a whole question of what the Masechta is, so I just found out today that we're learning Sanhedrin next year.
What's after Sanhedrin?
After Sanhedrin is...
Sorry,
I classified. Yeah, too much. I think Kedushin. Yeah. Actually, I saw just this time I shoot an email in, so I'll share it with you more officially later.
So why would it be an Asaka?
Right, so that's a fair question. How much we should get into that sugya now, it's a little bit of a tangent. There is significant literature about what exactly qualifies an asmakta, how modern situations fit, don't fit, lotteries, pools. There's a lot to say about it. Okay, so that's maybe just, I don't know what parak it's in Hinshu's postline next year. This is the third parak sugya. But in any event, so God willing, we'll get to it. But for now, we just need to know that the Gemara has two possible reasons as to what the psul of Masach of the Kuvi is. So one issue is that it's a form of theft. The other issue is, specifically really more about the professional gambler, that he's eino osek b'yeshuvo sholo. That because he sustains himself through this essentially non-productive endeavor, he's able to survive with the money he makes, but he's not doing anything for society. So therefore, that's a exclusion from testimony. So if that's the case,
is that part or soul or more of that makes him a Rasha?
So that's really the question. So that's what he wants to suggest here, that maybe you could say that answer maybe is not really about Rishos. It's that it comes out that a person with this kind of removal from the day-to-day events of society is not able to give reliable testimony. So if that's the case, maybe we could say that somebody who puts himself in this category doesn't really establish himself as a Rasha, just excludes himself from testimony for other reasons, and really more is casting aspersion on the content of his testimony rather than on himself. And maybe that's what we're actually getting. That's not a perfect approach, because the question is the Rambam would not work with that approach, where the Rambam formulates Masachet Bukovia. So it's a question. Rashi is a little bit different. But it opens up all kinds of fascinating avenues to consider what exactly really is the nature of the issue in terms of the psulim that I mentioned in the Mishnah, and how far does any other Mitzvah Rasha go. Now, essentially, we find that if we compare our sugya with the sugya in Yavamis, hopefully you got to see that this morning, so you find that there is a pretty big difference in terms of focus. In other words, that Yevamos is much more narrow, and our Gemara is much broader. Because when our Gemara brings in another Mason Asma Rasha, as we said, it comes up a lot of different ways through this Mishnah, but the way when the Gemara asks it, it's about a specific point, right? What's the Gemara focusing on? On the fact that they said, if this is what they said, that anusim anachnu machmos mama. Right, that if they say anusim anachnu machmos nefashos, right, basically the whole point of anusim is that they're saying that the shtar is false. We signed it under duress. So the shtar does not actually reflect anything that really happened. There was no hope. It's a total joke, the shtar. So, if they did that legitimately because they had a gun to their head, anusim anachnu machmos nefashos, okay, so fine, then maybe that could be credible. But, says the Gemara, if they did it, machmos mamo, so that's not a real onus. You know, they're basically saying that they signed a false shtar because of some kind of financial pressure. So, pashtus, that's an aveira. But parenthetically, it's interesting, and I gave you one more makom that's relevant to this, just to give you some of the background, that when you say anusim anachnu machmas nefashos, it's actually interesting also that there are some averos which you're not allowed to do even on threat of death. It's called Yehari Valyavah. So what if you do those averos? And so is that called anus or not? If somebody puts a gun to your head and tells you to do an act of gilui arayis, or to kill someone else, or to engage in a avodah zarah, right? So the din is yehari valyavah, you're not supposed to do it. So should we categorize that with anusim anachnu machmas mamo, that is essentially the same thing, it was illegitimate, it's just a straight out of there? Or it could be not. The view of the Rambam, which is fascinating, is that even though that's not the right decision to make, even though you're not supposed to violate these averos, even at gunpoint, But if you do, that's still called onus. You still didn't do it willingly. You still did it because somebody else forced you. So that could have ramifications here, right? Let's say somebody testifies that he violated one of the big three under threat of life. So do we say that, well, that's the same thing as what we're talking about here? Onus machmas mamon, it's not legitimate, so therefore you're just straight out Navarian? Or do we say that, no, even though the halacha doesn't endorse that call, but if you do it, it actually has the status of onus, and therefore Bezdin shouldn't punish.
What would the Rambam say, let's say, about blackmail, which is not a serious level, but it is being forced?
Right, but the question is, it's interesting. You know, save that question for tomorrow, because it actually could fit into our parsha topic, and it'll give us some synergy. So, it's funny, that's a very good question for tomorrow's parsha, and it connects it to the Zogir. Be here tomorrow and ask that question again, and you'll get synergy points. Yes, exactly, same time. You'll get synergy points, well, a little bit earlier. You'll get synergy points for that question. That's a great question. So, essentially, that's an interesting parenthetical issue here, that if somebody did an Avera that was not subject to a heter of onus, so should we say, okay, it's the same thing as what we're talking about here, it's not legitimate, it's just an Avera, or do you say at the end of the day, it's still an onus, even though it wasn't legitimate? So that's a question to keep in mind. But essentially, so our Gemara says that if it's a mamon case, so he has no right to do that, so why should we believe him? That essentially puts him in the category of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. This guy is coming to Beis Din and is saying, I falsified a document, I committed perjury in order to defraud someone else because of a monetary incentive or monetary pressure, something that's not a legitimate reason. So this guy just confessed to a crime. Now, think about that for a second, because that takes us at least two levels beyond where you might have thought this should go. Somebody want to help me out here? Why is this a little bit of a surprisingly broad application of, the Mason Matzmarash? Are you?
Because it's so much so that you won't even pay attention to if the shtar itself is possible.
Okay.
I mean, it could be that his status might be not changed, but what about the shtar itself?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think you're getting on, trying to figure exactly which point you're emphasizing. You're certainly on the right track. That the reason I called it two steps is because you'll see that sometimes you could have thought that you should take the content of what somebody's saying and you should bifurcate it. Right, what's that called in halacha? Hagira dibure, right? Which you see Tosus here asks about. Right, we find sometimes, for example, the Gemara says that if somebody was involved in the Avera of Mishkav Zachar with somebody else, so can he testify against the other party? So it depends. If he was raped, if he was honest, so then he's not involved in the Avera himself, so then he should be able to say that for sure as an aid. And if he was willing, so then it's possible also to say palgina dibure. Then maybe we'll say, all right, this will establish the testimony vis-a-vis what the other guy did, and it will kind of ironically get him off the hook because he will not be able to be prosecuted for his own role, but the other guy will. Maybe we could take the quality of the testimony and we could bifurcate palgina dibure. So here you could have thought, let's say that, right? Let's say that a person is essentially conveying two pieces of information. Let's not pay attention to the part where he labels himself a Rasha, and let's pay attention to the other part. So that's already one level beyond where you thought you could have gone. But there's another reason why it's even a level beyond that. Because here, you're really not interested at all in the substance of what he's saying. Now, if he says, I was a Rasha when I signed the shtar, we don't care that he was a Rasha. We don't care at all about the actual Avera he was involved in. Right? It's even further removed than the case you just mentioned, because all we're interested in is whether or not this shtar, I don't know if that's what you were saying before, all we're interested in is that this shtar does not really have Avera. This shtar is essentially a false document that the people who signed on it are saying, we didn't mean to sign. We signed under duress. So the actual story about what the duress was for, and the fact that it happens to incriminate the guy, that's really far removed from what we're interested in. So we can certainly grant him immunity for his avera, and still pay attention to the fact that the shtar is possible, or the shtar is lacking any hechsher, rather is really the way to phrase it, lacking any gear. So you see why that's a little bit of a surprisingly broad application of Ein Adam Meis Matzo Rasha. Not only will we not assign this person the Rasha status, but we won't pay attention to the other half of the sentence that has other applications either. And in this case, we don't care about the whole sentence. We don't care at all about the circumstances. All we care about is whether this shtar has Eidim or not. And we're willing to take it all the way to that length. Right, so this Gemara is essentially a very broad application of, you know, the Mesa Matzma Rush. While the Gemara in Yevamos really gives a much more narrow application. Because right, there the Gemara discusses about, the Gemara, you saw the Mishnah in Yevamos, that essentially the context is, we literally had one of those small Gemaras in Yevamos Kesubis in it, but the context is over there, that there are certain circumstances where a person wants to testify that a woman is single, she's divorced or widowed, so that she can marry somebody else. And the Mishnah says that if he was involved in that situation, so sometimes we say that he shouldn't marry her. So in that context, the Mishnah is talking about, let's say somebody comes and says, this woman is single, she's a widow, and she can remarry. How do I know? I killed her husband. And the guy comes and testifies that he is the murderer. So, at least according to one opinion in the Mishnah, and the way the Gemara reads it, it could be that that's valid testimony. Right? This guy to come and say that the man is dead and he knows because he's the murderer, so that could be accepted. Now, why is that? What's going on there? Clearly this guy has some issues. But the Gemara presents this in the context of the special kulas that we have for Eidos Isha. And I think we've talked about this a little bit in the context of Yevamos. The Gemara says that Eidos Isha does not mean the testimony of a woman, in this case, means testimony regarding a woman's single status. That we want to make it possible for women to remarry in the classical of women's situations that the Gemara in Yevamos talks about in so many places, that we're worried that a woman whose husband died and we can't prove it 100% in the way that we normally require proof, so we want her to be able to remarry. So the Gemara says that with certain corresponding chumras, we're makel to allow testimony we wouldn't otherwise allow. So there the Gemara discusses that a psul d'rabbanan we could allow in order to allow women to remarry, and maybe a psul d'oraisa, that's a machlokas in the Gemara. So it sounds like over there that theoretically, if you say that a psul d'oraisa you couldn't do, so that's what the Mishnah was coming off of, that the person comes and says he's the murderer, so the Mishnah has the opinion that such a person could not testify. And there, as the Gemara explains, because of, you know, the Mesa Matzma Rasha and a level of Psul D'Oraisa, so the parent can't come and testify that he's a murderer in order to allow the woman to remarry. Now, the Mishnah has another opinion on this point, so that's the context I was alluding to a few minutes ago. The Rambam and the Perush Mishnayos over there in Yevamos, the Rambam writes that the machlokas in the Mishnah is that the other opinion says, yes, ought to Mesa Matzma Rasha. That it is possible, and that's why, regardless of the issue of Eidos Isha, without any need for that, a person could simply be advised, could be accepted to say that he is a Rasha, and we won't have any exclusion like that. So that point we said before, that it might be a machlokas, the Mishnah, if this klal exists, that's where the Rambam makes this comment, the Rambam in the Perush of Mishnayos. So there, the idea that the woman could remarry, so there we really are, theoretically, we could narrow the, you know, the Mason Matzma Rasha just to his own murderer status, at least according to one opinion in the Gemara. So that's a very narrow application, right? We're saying that we could accept the testimony the husband was murdered, and simply not accepted vis-a-vis his own guilt in the matter. So in Yevamos you have a very narrow application, and here we have a broader application. We can't accept any part of what he's saying, nor can we even accept the aspersions cast upon the Shtar, because it involves making him a Rush. So how do you reconcile that? So that's an issue that many talk about, but let's just look together at the Tosfos, which, again, Tosfos and Yevamos and Ksuvos both address this, so let's just get them background in that. So we'll use the Tosfos and Ksuvos, because that's our neighborhood. So you see Tosfos over here, you know, the Meis Matzma Rasha, so asks Tosfos, you know, Toma, V'haka Sovarava, D'palgina D'bura Parakam D'Sanhedrin? So here, whether we're in the first parak or the third parak of Sanhedrin, so we got some teasers for it here. That the Gemara in the first parak of Sanhedrin, Rava's opinion is that you can split the facts. So why don't we accept that he's a Rasha and not the fact that, accept the fact that the Shtar is Pasul and not the fact that he's a Rasha? And the Gemara post explains the context. Gabi Ploni Ravani Lotzoni, Ploni Balishto, Alishti. So in Cain, if that's true, if we have such a concept of bifurcation, so Hacha and Ninu, so here, let's believe him. De anusim hayu, aval lo machmas momen ela machmas nefashos. Right. So why don't we believe half of what they're saying, not the other half? So let's believe them that they were anusim. Right. Let's believe them that the document is not credible, and the story that they're giving that it was because of momen. Let's not believe that part, since there is another possibility. It could have been gunpoint. So let's leave that possibility open. Just accept the point that the document is falsified and just take it from there. So Yeshu Elmar, so says Tosfos, very significant approach, which puts everything in an important context here. Kevan dekiyum shtaros drabanan, since our mission is really about kiyum shtaros, and that is a din drabanan, lo palgina dibure kidei lifsol hashtar. So that's already very important. So that maybe our Gemara is not so much about Eidei Mosim, Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha, and all the rules that go along with that. It's really a Kiyum Shtaros Mishnah. And it's just saying that this should cast aspersions on the Shtar. So Tosfos is saying, well, Kiyum Shtaros is Drabanan, which means that really the weight of the benefit of the doubt should go to the Shtar itself. So we're not going to engage in this bifurcation in order to undermine a shtar, which on a deraisa level doesn't need this whole process to begin with. The Ode, De'eman lomar me'atzmeinu danusim hayu machnas nefashos. Also, we are not going to say on our own that the likely onus came from life or death. The onus machnas nefashos lo shkiach, because it's not so likely. So if we're going to try to give a default assumption without accepting his testimony, so it's hard to say that we should use the default that is less likely, that is less common. Yes, sir?
Why is it that we have to assume the other side, that it was anusim achmos nefashos? Why don't we just accept that it was anusim achmos mamon and forget about that, pretend that it doesn't exist, and just accept the content? Meaning, why do we have to go to the other side and then give an answer that's not common?
Right, that's a very important hara, right? So what Aryeh is asking is that, you see, Tosfos is also telling us something about what it means to palgina divure, what it would mean to bifurcate. Right? So you could have thought that bifurcation means that if the sentence has two components, A and B, so I'll pay attention to A without paying any attention to B. I can ignore B completely. So it sounds like what Tosfos is telling us is, no, it's not true. You can't ignore B completely. It means you don't have to accept what he says about B, but you have to have open a possible avenue. You can't just say that, well, there's no way to make the scenario in a non-avera fashion, but I'll still accept the other half. It means that you can consider the other part not established. So if there's an avenue which is a non-avera way, so then you can accept that maybe that's a possible approach here. So to that, Tosfos is saying that that's considered to be the uncommon approach, so we're not going to be willing, especially under the circumstances that it's a Rabbanan situation, and the Shtar is kosher by default, we're not going to impose that here. And skipping a little bit towards the end, so it gives another answer. Nami hach ikar edus u'masha omr manusim hayinu shabo lomar shalo ro hamalve. Right, so here, the whole point of saying Anusim, they're coming to say that they didn't see the real Milva, they didn't see the loan. Imke miyad osin atzmu rishonim. So since that's the way they said it, so they immediately made themselves into evildoers. Kevan shechasmu im lo yasu perish l'devrehen. That since they signed, so that makes them to rishonim, unless they can explain what they did. Hilkech l'shayachach ha-palgin li-burei. So therefore, it doesn't make sense here to say palgin li-burei. Aval hahi daharaktiv, but in the case of Yevamos, where you say you killed the guy, so ikar edus ulomar shenehrag lahasiyas ishto, the main point of your testimony is to establish that the guy was killed so that his wife can remarry. V'chein ploni revo, and so too in terms of the Mishka Zacha, o ba'al ishto, ikar edus laharag ploni, the whole point is to convict the other guy for his avera, helkach pagin dibura. So there, in those cases, you can divide it up. So we can take the part that we need and the part to make his status that we're not going to take. So essentially, what is the second answer in Tosfos really telling us? How would you go to the core of what Tosfos is saying here?
When you're trying to destroy an entire testimony, Pagin and Dibure cannot work for one half of it.
Okay.
But when you are not going to the Iker Aegis itself, but you're just being, you're incriminating yourself that you can be Pagin and Dibure.
Okay. And to add on to that, I say that, you know, what Tosfos seems to be saying here is that to the extent that the item that we need can really be narrowed down, that we can isolate something for our purposes completely independently of the guilt of the aid, so then it might be acceptable. But in this case, the act itself, we're interested in the Kiyum Hashtar, and the Kiyum Hashtar is so directly affected by the Averu about which he is confessing that it becomes very difficult to separate that one from the other. Hi.
Does making oneself a Rasha mean that they can't testify? Meaning, if someone's Mason on some Rasha, that should seem to
Oh, so now let's talk about that. So that's a good segue question. So now, having seen this approach, having seen how Tosfos and Yevamos is very parallel to this, so having seen a little bit about how the Rishonim address these two conflicting sugyas, so now let's go back to the question which is relevant to what Ari is asking. So first of all, what is the nature of the Mason Matzmah Rasha? Why does the principle exist? What's it about? Right, so somebody help me out here. Why is there such a concept that edus about your own guilt should not be accepted? Why not?
Protecting.
So?
Not to protect you, but if you're going to make yourself a Russian from before, then why? Then maybe you're a Russian now. Meaning, if just as much so that you did something that you weren't supposed to do back then, and once we know that, once you're admitting that, once we know that, then why should I believe what your testimony now?
So I'll take your comment in a second because I think it's going in a different direction. So it's interesting. Well, your approach, this approach that's more evident in the Gemara and in Rashi, but what you're saying, there are some Achronim who say something along that, which I think is also what Ari was asking a minute ago. Right? So Bochanan, the Kovitz, Aris, Kivanos, maybe a few others also allude to this approach, that there is kind of a paradox, which you have to figure out where you go with this paradox, but you can't both be a kosher aid and establish yourself as an avarian at the same time. So we're going to have to take one or the other. And that if you are indeed a avarian, so then that means that your testimony is possible. If your testimony is possible, then we have no basis to call you an avarian. If we call you an avarian, we can't take testimony about anything else. So it's an interesting question where that should leave you. Right? One might say we should leave it as a suffix regarding everything that you do. But essentially, that's an approach that some have, that this inherent paradox that you can't accept testimony from you if essentially it's going to put you in a situation where you are possible aides. But there are a couple of other approaches, so we'll take Evan's point first.
First off, aside from the fact that like Rashi and Tosafot seems to take it in a more technical manner, that you're karovet to yourself.
Oh, right. So we'll mention that first. I know you have something else to say, but let's mention that first. Right. So it sounds like from Rashi and the Gemara in Yevamos and elsewhere mentions the two points together. Well, you could argue a little bit about the relationship that the Gemara does invoke them adjacent, giving you the impression that they are related concepts. That Adam karav etzel atzmo, that a person in general cannot testify about relatives, and you are related to yourself. So that's a fascinating idea, because you have to consider what are the implications. Because really, though, it's not about rishus at all then. It's really just about the fact that your testimony about yourself should not be considered, because you're no getting.
Have you ever said you're guilty?
Sorry?
Have you ever said you're guilty?
You can't. Well, that's what the Nation means. And so the question is, why should it be limited to guilt? Maybe you should say that there are other areas also which are going to be subject to such a soul. So is there another approach?
Yeah, I was saying before that to protect you from some type of cross-examination approach, where if you're not allowed to make yourself Russia, if we don't believe any testimony regarding yourself, you can never be backed into a corner where and have a whole case thrown out simply because of someone that's not necessarily related in the affair that you did, which would make you categorically a Russia.
All right, so that's interesting. So let's think about that for a minute, because it's not certainly not explicit here, but there could be a basis to say that. So I asked at the outset, does this have any kind of a connection to the principle in American law of the Fifth Amendment and the right to avoid self-incrimination? So maybe there is some connection. Again, you have to, it's a little bit speculative, but maybe there is what to say. That I think what supports it a little bit is, as the Gemara has elsewhere, then when the Torah says Arshei Arshia, a person who has been declared as a sinner, so the Gemara has the phrase Prat v'Marshia Satmo, that this will exclude somebody who condemns himself, which you could read as saying that essentially it's a function of how Onesh works, right? That basically how punishment works and how the whole system of condemnation, that to whatever extent condemnation and punishment is a mitzvah in the Torah, it, by its very nature, it has to be external. It's not something that somebody does to himself, it's something that the community does to him, that the Eidim does to him. And that for him to do it himself is outside that whole structure of how the process is supposed to work. Now, you could take that further, you don't have to come to this conclusion, and you could say, why should that be? I'll be Tamei HaMitzvah, so I'll be Ashkafa, why should it matter? So it could be that punishment in general is a function of society, meaning that society has to impose punishment on the Avarian and not the Avarian doing it on himself. And parenthetically, there is a whole interesting literature. Kajibar Barav has a truth about this and others, that when you have the mitzvah of Ruge Bezdin, Bezdin is executing somebody, so does that create any kind of a mitzvah on the defendant too? See, a part of that mitzvah, is this something society is doing to him, or is he also a part of it? So the post can talk about, for example, is there an issur, if you're convicted by Bezdin, is it also for you to run away, if you could escape? Do you have a chiyuv here also, or is it the tzibor's chiyuv, and it's not your chiyuv at all? What about the fact that the person is given some kind of intoxicating substance when he's executed, so he's not technically speaking, involved in mitzvahs at the time? Or what if, this question comes up in America all the time, what if the person is a shota, if the person is potter from mitzvahs, how does that affect the mitzvah of mitzvahs bezdin? So there is, possibly a whole structure you could discuss, that the whole process of rishus and condemnation and onesh is supposed to come davka from outside, and the individual cannot do this to himself. Now, it is raising an interesting issue, that maybe you could say that this is a protection, which fits with other things that we see, right? That we see, for example, again, here's some great Sanhedrin advanced synergy, that if you learn Sanhedrin, so you see that there is tremendous benefit of the doubt given to the accused. And the accused has all kinds of advantages and edges. So it could be that maybe she's saying this is part of it. That Lu Yitzuya, or if we were going to say that the accused himself is able to put himself in a category of onesh through what he says, who knows what kind of pressure that could open him up to, who knows what kind of mistakes that could lead to. So maybe as a schus to the accused, in line with many of the others of previous refining to the accused, it's that the testimony against him has to be completely external, cannot be at all from him, so he shouldn't be subject to questioning or pressures or anything else that would force him to say something against his interest, and therefore, in order to protect him from such abuses, or if we consider the whole thing an abuse, so then we take everything off the table. That whatever he's going to say is fruit of the poison tree, essentially, to use again American legal terminology, that right off the bat we say that whatever he says is not helpful in terms of convicting him, or in terms of changing his status. So that could be too. One question about that?
There's another answer, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe in the Rambam, I think that we're afraid that the person's only admitting it in order to do suicide by court, in order to...
Rambam says in Mar Yeruchim?
I think it's in Ages.
Okay. Interesting to get that. Yeah. So that's, maybe that's quite...
We're afraid that the person is psychologically not capable.
So that actually, you know, would kind of go towards Zabin's category, not exactly in the very specific sense we were talking about, but it all is part of it that we are worried about abuses that could come about through the person testifying by himself, and therefore we have a protection against that, that anything he says that goes towards his goal is all off the table. Maybe.
I'm not sure if this is what you were asking earlier now, but do we ever assume that maybe he's doing teshuva and trying to correct himself?
For what purpose do you think? Is he saying the confession is part of tshuva?
Sorry?
He's saying the confession is part of tshuva, and therefore what we do with that impression? So therefore that's a reason to...
Maybe believe him now instead of believe his testimony, which is today.
And therefore what you're saying, we should, because it's an act of tshuva. Yeah. So that's also an interesting question. I think there's some more parts to this, and if we're going to run out of time, so maybe we'll fill that in next time. But there is another approach that you find Dafkin the sugya, and I think we'll finish this point now, and then we'll fill in more a little bit next time. But Shmaisa, Sheikh Shmaisa had another approach, which is also specifically this sugya relevant. That it could be that the individual has a cheskesh kashus, that we assume throughout halacha that the person has a presumption of validity, and a person presumption of innocence, and your testimony against yourself is not strong enough to undo that. Now, that needs a lot more explanation, because many ask that if that's true, so then your testimony shouldn't be any good against anyone else with cheskes kashrus either. Right? So everyone who is brought in front of Dezman has a cheskes kashrus unless they don't. So, if that's the issue, so why does any testimony work? So, you could answer that question. There are all kinds of differences, right? We could say that your testimony is particularly weak against yourself for reasons that we've possibly discussed in the past 2 minutes. There are ways to address that question. You have to figure out exactly why, if it's about going up against the cheskes kashrus, why is that only a problem about you and not anyone else? But the truth is, in our sugya, it's particularly helpful, possibly. Because it could be that our sugya, again, is directly connected to what we were talking about yesterday and the day before. So we're up against something pretty strong, right? We're up against the shtar. And the shtar, especially, we say, kim shtaros is drabanan. So, and that's also what the Tosus we just saw was alluding to. And that, we could read this now into the words of the Tosus that we saw a few minutes ago. And we're saying that, listen, the shtar is minatar rakasha. Kiyum shtaros is midrabanan. So now, this guy coming in, who wants to undermine it, who wants to say that it was signed by Apostle A, so he's really got a pretty high burden. You know, the whole fact that we're listening to anybody about this is only an institution midrabanan. So now, he wants to come and tell us that it's no good because he was a Rasha? Right? So that's quite a hurdle. So we could say that the Chezkas Kashrus that comes not only because he's previously known as an innocent Jew, but because he's the Eid on the Shtar. So the whole package, that Shtar, we have a principle, part of what we were alluding to the other day about the inherent qualities of a Shtar is that a Shtar testifies to its own Kashrus, right? That's what we said earlier in the week. So what does that mean? It means that it testifies to the Kashrus of the Eid. We have this principle, as Tosfos says it, Nistal Nakol Behechsher Nase, that the assumption of the Shtar is that it was done validly. The assumption is that if somebody lent money and had a contract written up, that he used Kasher Eden. So it's not a simple Cheskes Kashrus. This is a much more powerful Cheskes Kashrus.
I don't believe you're bringing Cheskes Kashrus.
Yeah, but the Cheskes Kashrus is stronger here, right? It's not simply that everybody you know has Cheskes Kashrus. Is that the Shtar has its own inherent credibility. And so part of that credibility is that the Eidim are kosher. So now for this guy to come with the self-incrimination principle, which itself is already a weak point, as we've established, and he wants to use that to go against the Shtar, which is itself establishing his Cheskes Kashrus in a above average kind of way, so maybe it's specifically within our sugya that in the Mason Atzma Rasha has a broader application. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right, so let's quickly review. We spoke about this. There's some more to say about this. We'll have to come back to it, but we'll stop in. So we'll just go over the points that we said now, and then we'll continue. So essentially, what did we see today? So we said the principle in the Mason Atzma Rasha. We established that it's really invoked by punishments, tzedakah, and not by straight monetary obligations, what we call mammon as opposed to knas, where we say mode of knas pater, but by the onshin, I'm sorry, we say that mode of knas pater, but by mammon hodas baldin kamei eidim dami, so Rashi Nivamis makes explicit that distinction, but by onshin, mammon, malchus, and personal status, we say, you know, demes matzma rasha, and that seems to be a pretty unanimous principle. The Rambam suggests it's machlokas tanoim in the Mishnah Nivamis that we were talking about, but for the most part, it seems to be a pretty widely across the board held principle. And then we notice that there are some different applications. That in our Mishnah, when the Mishnah says Kulam, so Rashi invokes both Krovim and Mestach B'Kubia. So other Rishonim say you can't say Mestach B'Kubia. That'd be a problem, Mesim Asma Rasha. So we talked a little bit about what Mestach B'Kubia is exactly. Some Rishonim defend Rashi by saying it's a Psol Midrabana, and we tried to figure out how that would help because why does Drabana Deraisa make a difference? What exactly is the issue of Mesim Asma Rasha? Is it about saying anything bad about yourself, or is it about status? It would seem either way that this is a status issue, so it wouldn't help to call it Drabana. We mentioned the approach of the Birkas Avram that focuses on the Sachet B'Kuvia as Eino Osik Yeshiva Sholola. Maybe it's not about Rishos, but really rather about not being credible, and so therefore it's not about him, but that's not really a perfect answer for a couple of reasons. So Rashi's a little bit difficult. And we discussed the difference between our sugya and Nivamos. Our sugya is a very broad application. Not only do we not split his testimony and bifurcate it and take part without the Rishos part, but here especially, we'd be more likely to do that, you would think, because the Shtar is really not interested at all in his Aveira. It's just interested in whether it has Eidim or not. So if we could just take apart that the Shtar is absent Eidim, that itself would be enough for our purposes. So it's surprising that it's applied so broadly here, especially in light of Yevamos, where it's possible that you could accept the testimony of a murderer that the person he murdered is dead in order to allow his wife to remarry. So we saw Tosfos here, which discusses some of the possible distinctions, focuses on the fact that Kiyum Shtaros is Drabanan, and that therefore the threshold is pretty high to undermine the Shtar, and we're not going to bifurcate the testimony under those circumstances, adding in also the fact that the scenario that we have to invoke would be a pretty unlikely scenario, making it harder to allow that to be the default, and also the possibility that here the datum that we need is so narrow that it's hard to bifurcate away the stuff about his rishus. We then also considered the question of what is the reason for the psul. We saw a couple possibilities. The Gemara and Rashi sound like the issue is Adam Karveitz Latzmo. We consider a little bit the implications of that. Also, what the point that Rabbi Chanan and others made, that there's an inherent paradox that we can't both believe his testimony and call over Russia at the same time. And then discussed also the possibility that this is a schus for the defendant, that he should have, among his other privileges and benefits, that he should not be pressured into incriminating himself. So maybe we take all of his testimony off the table from the beginning. And then the possibility of the Shmaisa discusses that he is ineffective against his Cheskas Kashrus, which in general you have to figure out why does that not cause all kinds of other problems to testimony. But in our sugya, it's perhaps especially helpful to take an approach like that, because here we're not dealing stam with a Cheskas Kashrus, we're dealing with a shtar, which in HaTorah does not need kiyum. And as we've been discussing this week, so one of the elements of the shtar is that not only is it effective for its message, but it also reflects on its own kashrus, which therefore reflects also on the kashrus of the Eidim. So maybe there is a particularly high threshold here, and this guy coming and saying, I was a Russia, so together with all the baggage of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Russia, it's not going to be enough to undermine his shtar, which on a Torah level testifies to his cheskas kashrus in the first place. All right, so we will pause there, and we will continue this next time. Again, stay tuned for what time we start tomorrow. It'll be a little bit earlier than normal. All right, so we'll...